Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on the future of data protection by Robert Hopkins. This talk was given at the 11KBW Information Law Conference on the 2nd of March 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Chris is right. Year after year, I stand here and blather at you all earnestly about serious data protection stuff. But what data protection talks really need is an injection of popular culture. I take my lesson. Here's my opening gambit. Who's that guy? Options: a political bigwig, cult film star, or a data protection nerd? Any guesses? John Baines, what about you?
Probably AMC.
Well, I'll tell you his name first, tell you who he is, and then we'll explore the options. Don't be fooled by the vaguely Zuckerbergian veneer. This man is Jan-Philipp Albrecht, a 35-year-old German MEP and data protection rapporteur who has piloted through the general data protection regulation that I'll be talking to you about today. So I've covered off with that brief introduction political bigwig and data protection nerd, but what about film star? Well, my favourite data protection film, not sure about yours, is called Democracy. And it's a film about Jan-Philipp Albrecht's journey to pilot this crucial piece of legislation through the European legislative process. So I do recommend it. Popcorn and Netflix in the Hopkins household on a Saturday night. Oh, you should see the children's faces. One of the problems with the film, though, Democracy, and this is serious, it was a film released in Germany. One of the problems is that it ends in 2014, I think on a sort of budgetary or production assumption. Oh, well, they'll get it all wrapped up by then, won't they? No such luck. And it's that's where the film leaves you. So if you need to understand what's actually in the data protection regulation, that's not going to help you, but I will try. So here's some other popular culture attempt from me. Introducing our new data protection world order, some brief history of the various stages through which data protection evolution has, in my view, tracked the unfolding of the Star Wars dynasty. Early 80s, 1984's Data Protection Act, then supplanted by what we now base our data protection law on, that is the 95 directive, and our beloved Data Protection Act 1998. But the 20-teens, of course, bring a completely different world. The draft for the text of the regulation was first leaked in December 2011. Wagnerian drama of intense political debate behind the scenes produce a final agreed text in December 2015. That's the text we'll have a look at today. When is it going to start making a difference? No precise dates, but it's likely that it's going to be adopted around May of this year, with about a two-year lead-in time before it comes into force. The quote on the bottom tells us what the current draft, what the directive, the regulation itself says about the predecessor directive. Suggestion is, it was a good thing, its essential logic is sound, but there has been fragmentation. In other words, things aren't applied consistently across the union, and there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of insecurity about whether or not data subjects' rights are being properly safeguarded. And that's the driving force behind this new world order. In broad terms, you will see lots that is familiar. There will be plenty of you who are briefing clients, internal and external, and there is a sense of apocalyptic fervour in some quarters. Everything will be completely different. Clean the slate totally. Start from scratch. Well, that's not quite true. The broad architecture, the broad logic behind data protection law will remain the same. Pivotal concepts of data controllers, data subjects, personal data, principles that have to be adhered to, and how you go about enforcing them. But there are very important, specific new rights and obligations, and an underlying, extremely important difference in emphasis that one finds coursing through the veins of the General Data Protection Regulation. What I'm going to do today then is put aside the slightly laboured Star Wars theme, which I regretted a bit, but it was really hard to pull out the graphics and it misaligns the text. So we'll leave that for the moment. So what I'm going to do is introduce in broad and rapid terms the big chunks of the General Data Protection Regulation. There are lots of you who are experts in or interested in enormous detail on some of these sections. This session doesn't have the time for that, tries to set out in lots of slides that might help you with a broad overview. But what I'm going to do is outline in overview terms what the regulation is about, and I'll do it in these conceptual ways. What is its reach in terms of data controllers? Number one. Two, what is its reach in terms of the type of information that it deals with, personal data? Three, what are the principles that data controllers have to abide by? Four, what are the rights data subjects have? Five, what are the obligations that are imposed on data controllers? Six, how do we check that these rights and obligations are satisfied? And seven, what bad things will happen to you if you get things wrong? So our first heading, this is about data controllers. The definition of data controller remains essentially the same. But the interesting point, the important developments to note, is the widening reach in territorial terms of the type of data controller activity that is brought within the net of data protection responsibilities. Article 2 tells us about this. A note from the definition. It's got, like our current Section 5 of the DPA, a number of options. The first of them is not about where the data is processed, but where the controller or processor note, or processor, so the processor starts to become a focal point as well, where they are established and if the processing is taking, if the processing is in the context of that establishment. Particularly number two is one to point out. And this puts data subjects very much in the driving seat. You will be brought in, you as a data controller, your processing activities will be subject to the GDPR if you're processing the personal data of European data subjects. That includes offering them services. Doesn't matter whether they have to pay for those goods or services, but whether you are offering them, whether you are offering them a good or service of any kind, or you are monitoring their behaviour. Now you can see the width of that that territorial reach immediately. Social networks, cookies, apps, platforms that are interested in not charging people, but in understanding their behavior or offering a service of that kind that may not have any establishment, may not set foot in, may not have an office in the European Union, but they are processing the personal data of data subjects based in the European Union, and that brings them within the net of the GDPR's obligations. Compare that to Section 5 of the Data Protection Act as we know it, which I summarized there, but spot this key point. The old world, or the current world, the Data Protection Act approach, is very much focused on how you as a data controller are established. How do your operations work? Have you got sufficient connection in terms of your establishment, or do you use equipment other than for transit, equipment in the European Union? Well, just to jump back to our new world, never mind focusing exclusively on how the data controller operates. Think about it from the data subject's point of view. If the data subject is European Union based, you are likely to be brought within the net. Represents what many describe as a global ambition for data protection law at a European level. Second heading, what about personal data? Is there much change? Is that going to be a wider, more difficult thing to deal with? Well, answer, not really. I've set out there Article 2, that's the current directive's definition, and with some underlined bits in the new definition under Article 4, it doesn't change things in any significant way, except that it does seek to put beyond doubt questions like, can an IP address be personal data? The introduction of, for the avoidance of doubt language, like identifiers such as name identification number, location data, or online identifier. What that's seeking to do is to say, yes, we know you've been arguing about this, some of you, in the years gone by, and we do mean things like that too. Not to say that every identifier will qualify as personal data, but it is seeking to give a firm steer on some of the questions that have troubled lawyers and data controllers in the past. A couple of additional concepts, words that you would not find in the 1995 directive that you do find present in the GDPR. Pseudonymization is one of them. And that's an important concept. Pseudonymization is something that a lot of you are already familiar with. It's trying to take information that is about readily identifiable individuals and code it or strip out overt identifiers so that you can still figure out, if you need to, who's who, but someone picking up the spreadsheet or document wouldn't immediately be able to glean who the individuals are. That's the practice of pseudonymization. Important point. Pseudonymized data is still personal data. Might not look like it, but it is still personal data. Despite that, it's quite a big deal in the GDPR. Pseudonymization is a theme that recurs a number of times, and really for these reasons, that pseudonymization is introduced as something that the regulation expressly expects from data controllers. Pseudonymization in the current world is something that you might or might not do. It's really up to you whether you think it's a good idea to try and reduce privacy impacts. In the new world, as part of your data security obligations, you will be expected to show, well, yes, I considered or I tried or I implemented pseudonymization as a way of minimizing any privacy risks for data subjects. Demonstrate that, and you're likely to be cut more slack in terms of regulatory or judicial action. Fail to demonstrate that. In other words, say, well, yes, I've lost that data. No, it wasn't pseudonymized. And no, I didn't really think about doing that. And you will be in more difficulty. Genetic and biometric data are expressly referred to in the sensitive personal data category, but probably no surprise there. The third heading, what about the principles that have to be adhered to? We know them in our domestic legislation as the data protection principles from Schedule 1 to the DPA. The GDPR sets them out in Article 5. It uses neat, catchy handles for what the principles are, and most of them look very familiar to you. No big surprises here, and I summarise what they are. You will see how they correspond to our current data protection principles. So in outline terms, familiar territory. But note at the bottom of that slide the accountability principle that is introduced. Again, part of an increased onus on making sure not only that data controllers are complying with the obligations, but that they are consistently thinking about, checking, verifying, and are able to demonstrate that they are complying with those principles, that their systems and approaches to personal data are sound. That's express recognition is something that will increase the pressure on data controllers to have their house in order. Lawful processing, we're still sitting here within the principles, and think of these now in terms of conditions from Schedule 2 to the DPA as you know it. Got to tick one of those boxes. Again, they are largely familiar, not huge changes, but note our beloved Condition 6.1 from Schedule 2, the legitimate interests condition, the one everyone reaches for where they think, well, I can't find a specific reason to justify why I'm wanting to do this, so I'll go for the legitimate interest one. I can use that, can't I? Answer, yes, you can, but note that there has been a debate for some time about whether that condition was ever intended to be available to public authorities. In the new world, the answer will be no, and that will be a matter of some consequence for lots of types of data processing activities that public authorities are expected to do, particularly in a world, for example, where local authorities are expected to pursue lots of objectives and functions, raise money, do lots of good things, have general empowerments, but then get the rug pulled out from under them when it comes to using personal data on that ground, at least. Purpose limitation. Lots of hand-wringing and data controller anxiety about that principle. That's not going to go away, The questions will still arise, like, well, I collected the data for this purpose, so I didn't think at the time that I might want to use it for something else, but can I? Am I ruled out from doing that? The answer is no. You can, of course, use data for a different purpose. Can't be an incompatible purpose with the one you collected it for. Can be a different purpose. How do you decide whether the whether it's okay to use it for that different purpose? Well, the GDPR gives us some considerations, links between the original purpose and the new one, the context of the collection, the relationship between controller and subject, the nature of the data, what implications or consequences will there be for data subjects, and what are the safeguards? Consent, upping the bar of consent is an important feature of the GDPR. You heard from Chris about some case law that explored under the current regimes, what does consent mean? Under the GDPR, there is a direct taking that bull by the horns and raising the bar. It wants to move away from a world where data controllers can stretch the meaning of consent to shoehorn in lots of things that they subsequently want to do. So look at the two definitions of consent that you see there. Nothing especially groundbreaking except for that word, unambiguous indication of his or her wishes. That's the key difference here. What a lawyer's minefield. Imagine the arguments about what is or is not unambiguous. That is the one that clients will be particularly interested in. Is my current regime for consent good enough? Want to be guiding them towards, well, unambiguous is our new objective. If you are relying on consent as your ground for justifying the processing that you're doing, note a number of points that, as I say, really raise the bar if you're going to be able to say, yes, I processed that data, and my reason is that you consented to it. You've got to be able to demonstrate that consent was given. You can't bury consent terms in the small print. You've got to recognize that data subjects can withdraw their consent at any time. Here's an important one. You can't approach consent on a take it or leave it basis. In other words, you can't simply say something like this. Well, I was offering a commercial service in a free market. One of the terms of accepting my service is that I get to do X, Y, and Z with your personal data. If you don't like it, just don't use me. Go somewhere else. I'm not making you take up my service. You're choosing to. So it's up to you. It's your choice. No, says the GDPR, you can't approach the offering of a good or service that way. It can't be on a take it or leave it basis. You can't say to the data subjects, do business with me and I get to decide or I get to put your data to the purposes that I specify. It's got to be genuine consent. Data subjects' rights. This is an area, this is really the heart of the new regime, a fleshed out, much more data subject focused, much more concrete, developed, detailed, muscular set of rights that are conferred upon data subjects. As I say, one of the defining features of this whole regime is a shift towards making sure that data subjects are or feel like they are in control of what happens to their personal data. Shift away from a focus on a balance between controllers and subjects to a much more expressly developed set of rights for data subjects. Fair processing is again something you heard from Chris on this morning. It's starting to bare its teeth even under the old regime, the current regime. Let's think, for example, of the Barra case that Chris discussed. The new regime, in Article 14 in particular, will see it become even more prominent. The rights themselves are similar to the ones that we now have. The rights to be told what's going to happen to your personal data, who the data controller is, and so on. The rights that are set out in Schedule 1 of the DPA. But there are a few other things that you now will need to include in your fair processing notices. For example, you must tell data subjects about the storage periods that you envisage applying to their personal data. Now, there are not many data controllers who currently do that, in my experience, and that's because they're not overtly required to. But if pressed, would they be able to say up front at the point of collection, well, these are the principles by which I will decide how long I hold your personal data for? Quite a lot of the time, the answer is, well, I don't know yet. I'll think about that as I go along. Fair processing requirements in our new world order will require you effectively committing yourself to that up front. And that is a big, significant shift to how data controllers think about their personal data processing operations. You also have to expressly alert the data subject to their rights. They can withdraw consent, they can complain, they can seek rectification, and so on. You also have to provide them with meaningful information about profiling and other automated decision making. And that, again, is one of the driving themes behind the new GDPR text, is that there are lots of automated or online processing platforms for personal data. People do a lot of their they live a lot of their lives online now. That in technology raises new modes of processing and analysis of personal data, which is it's very difficult for individuals to understand. Meaningful information about how you go about those activities is something you will now be expected to provide. I mentioned changing your purpose, using personal data for a purpose different to the one you collected it for. Yes, you can do that, and I pointed out some of the considerations that you would need to go through if you wanted to change your purpose, put personal data to a new purpose. Also, remember that if you do start to use personal data for a purpose different to the one you collected it for, a new set of fair processing requirements kicks in. Not enough just to say, well, I was justified in doing it. You've also got to make sure that you lay your cards on the table and help data subjects understand the new purposes that you're putting the personal data to. Subject access, everyone's favorite topic. Is this something to cause data controllers further groans in our new GDPR world? Answer, not really. The scope of the rights is largely the same as the one you're already familiar with, except that you're also entitled to be told as part of your request what safeguards the data controller has in place for international transfers. And this, again, driven by Schrems-type litigation that Chris outlined, concerns by data subjects on I'm not only interested in what you, the data controller, are doing with my personal data, I also want to understand, is it leaving the EU? And if so, what safeguards have you got in place for it? When must you comply? Well, of course, without undue delay, but you all do that anyway. Within 1 month of the receipt of the request is the time frame that the GDPR envisages. You can take up to an additional 2 months where it is necessary for you to do so, and if you can justify why you need that additional time. But you must remind data subject requesters that they can complain about it if you miss the deadlines. Charging and excessive burden, what about those? Well, starting point is that you're not supposed to, you're not allowed to charge. It's a right exercisable for free. But, and here are some silver linings, some positives from data controllers' points of view, the Article 12.4 provisions set out in the last bullet on that slide. You are entitled to go through a thought process, like a piece of analysis like this. I take the request. I feel confident as a data controller in labeling this as manifestly unfounded or excessive. And here are my reasons why. I can justify why I've taken that view of your request. I've corresponded with you, data requester. I've tried to show you, look at the burdens you're imposing on me, and still you press on. So I say it's manifestly excessive. I can do one of two things then as a data controller. I can charge you some reasonable fee to cover the costs I incur in going through all the work that you want me to do, or I can refuse the request. And that will be welcome to data controllers and will be seen as an introduction of common sense and potentially removing lots of big headaches. But note that you as the data controller need to be able to demonstrate that all the elements of that are made out. Brief walk through some of the other eye-catching rights of data subjects. Article 16, the right to rectify inaccuracies and to complete incomplete data. looks quite a lot like the rights that you think you data subjects already have now. Rights and remedies, for example, under Section 14 of the DPA, to seek rectification. Note the express introduction of the right to provide a supplementary statement where you consider that the data held about you is incomplete or inaccurate. Now, that we could spend a lot of time talking about how that might play out. I won't do that now, but just think through some of the scenarios. Someone says to a departing employer, I want to see what you have on file about me, including, say, my sickness absences or my disciplinaries or what my line managers said about me. I don't agree with that. I think it's an incomplete picture of me. I want to add my own clarifying statements to keep on that file, please. And I want to do that because I think if I need references from you later on down the line, someone's going to reach for that file. And I want to make sure they're seeing a picture that I, as a data subject, feel is complete and accurate. So potential big implications in those italicized words. The right to be forgotten exists now. It's put on a formalized footing under Article 17. There are a number of grounds on which you can choose to exercise it, and there are exemptions, including for freedom of expression, archiving and research. I'm not going to get into these in more detail. I think Anya this afternoon will discuss the right to be forgotten and how it plays out. Some further rights. If the right to be forgotten is the delete please option, Article 17A, the right to restrict processing, is something like a pause please option, recognises that sometimes there will be a need for a middle ground between I'm not happy with the personal data you have about me, delete it now, and a data controller just proceeding and riding roughshod over that. So the right to restrict processing might arise, for example, when there is a dispute between the data controller and the data subject about the accuracy of the information, or when the data controller doesn't need the information anymore, but the data subject thinks, I don't want you to erase that, delete that information, because it may be important to my exercise of my future rights. The right to data portability under Article 18, that is, you should be able to get machine-readable electronic data on your that, for example, is constitutes your own profile that you can transfer to another service provider or another platform without hindrance from the initial controller. Article 19 is the right to object to how information about you is being processed. That again, it's think of it in terms of the Section 10 rights at the moment under the Data Protection Act. Right to object to the processing about you. Note that the requirement, again, the onus is squarely put back on to the data controller to do what the data subject asks for. Please stop the processing you're doing, unless the data controller can demonstrate that there is some compelling interest in it doing what it's doing. Current world, data subject has to advance reasonable grounds, and you can head them off by saying, well, I'm sorry, I don't consider your request reasonable. I'm not going to comply with your Section 10 notice because you haven't made out a reasonable case for me to stop doing what you're doing. The new world, default setting is, well, yes, you do have to comply with the objection unless you, the data controller, can bring yourself within that unless condition. Article 20, right not to be subjected to a decision based solely on automated processing. That's again recognizing how much of a role profiling places plays in people's lives these days. And if profiling or automated analysis of personal data has legal consequences for you or other significant effects on you as a data subject, you have a right, again, subject to exceptions. You have an in principle right to say, I don't want that. There are, of course, exemptions, as there are now, in data subjects' rights. Harmonization is one of the key driving themes of the GDPR. In other words, making sure it's the same across the European Union. But significant matters of exemptions, for example, are left to member states. Data controllers, our next heading in brief. What additional liabilities, burdens are there? What do data controllers have to do that they're not already doing? Well, there's a general emphasis and a repeated refrain on accountability, accountability, data controller must be able to demonstrate that it is complying with the requirements, that it's got appropriate organizational technical measures in place. You need designated data protection officers. You need to build in data protection by design and default. They've long been sexy buzzwords in privacy circles. The GDPR actually wants data controllers to start building that in to how personal data is processed. What does that mean? Well, in very broad terms, don't just go about all your processing blindly ignoring privacy consequences and then try and sort of plug the holes as the dam starts to leak. When you are setting up a business, say, think about it up front. What are the privacy implications? Can I minimize the privacy implications for the people whose data I'm going to use? Can I pseudonymize? Can I take steps like that? You're required to maintain records of your processing. If you work in conjunction with another data controller, you've got to assign the responsibilities between yourself. You're not allowed just to wait till something bad happens and then say, sorry, wasn't it you who was going to look after that part? You have to think about these things and document them up front. Even stricter controls of the controller-processor relationship than we have now. It's a bit like our Schedule 1 of the DPA, which is quite detailed on what you have to do if you use a data processor, but additional specifications on selecting reliable processors, contractual controls, and making sure that if there is a sub-processing chain going on, that the agreements follow through in that chain and aren't simply that a line isn't simply drawn at the first stage where controller says to processor, okay, in your hands now, over to you to make sure things are all right. Look at the Article 29 specification of what appropriate measures for data security include. Not exhaustive, but this is the sort of yardstick that is set. This is where you and your clients will need to be making sure that you are able to tick these boxes at a minimum. Are you using pseudonymization and encryption? What can your systems actually, are they resilient enough to ensure confidentiality and coping with? Can you restore data if there is a system fault? Have you thought this through? Have you got in place processes for testing your systems to make sure that they are robust and are likely to comply with the GDPR before something bad happens? These are positive obligations, shifts to a world of after the event, oh, let me audit how things were because something bad has gone on, to a world of upfront thinking and assessing of those requirements. Breach notification is a big issue in the GDPR. What do you have to do if there has been a data breach? Well, you have to notify your regulator within 72 hours, unless you can justify why you've taken longer to do that. Do you have to notify the data subjects if there's been a breach or you've lost their data? Initially, there was thought that the answer would be yes, you always do if you're a data controller. Many felt that that was a terrible and self-defeating idea. Article 32 now sets that out in more nuanced terms. Where the breach that's happened is likely to result in high risks to the rights or freedom to the data subjects, then yes, without delay, you've got to tell the data subject, but see the unless conditions, the exceptions. If what really happened is you did have robust enough systems in place, but something happened and they didn't work, someone got round them in ways that weren't your fault, or you have taken such appropriate mitigating action as to put out the potential fires and reduce the risks, or there is disproportionate effort in contacting the data subject. So some comfort there for data subjects, for data controllers in the extent to which they need to alert subjects to data breaches. International transfers, broadly the same architecture as one sees now, and Chris has talked through current and future of transfers, so I'm not going to dwell on that. Penultimate heading, how do we ensure that these rights and obligations that I've been summarising are satisfied under our new GDPR world order? Well, first and major point, of course, is that it's down to the regulator, the supervisory authority, here the ICO. The Articles 52 and 53 of the GDPR set out very lengthy lists of powers and responsibilities for regulators. And here is bulletproof comfort to all of you from the ICO. The requirements under Article 47.5 to make sure that the regulator's got enough money to do all that stuff. No problems there, I'm sure. Now, making sure that standards are the same across the EU was one of the main ambitions behind the GDPR in the first place. Harmonisations and one-stop shops. That's why we have a regulation rather than a directive. A regulation is directly applicable without the need for domestic implementing legislation. It doesn't work quite like that. So we do have a regulation that has direct effect across the European Union, but the regulation text contains a number of carve-outs that say it is for the member state to decide how to implement this objective. Another example for Anya to deal with this afternoon, I think, is freedom of expression. Member states are required to deal themselves with how you balance freedom of expression and data protection rights. So we're not going to get full harmonisation across the EU. There are lots of clashes and inconsistencies that loom. The one-stop shop idea was another driving force. You as a data controller or a data subject should know who you can complain to, who's in charge if you are operating in a number of countries. Well, the broad idea is this. You will have a lead supervising authority in each case. They're the one in charge. They're the ones you have dialogue with and report to. But other supervising authorities can muscle in too. And they can do that and have their say on a dispute if it only affects data processing or subjects in their country, or via the consistency mechanism if they have got something to say about the principles that another regulator is enforcing. So again, one-stop shop is not quite where we get to. Remedies, lastly, what happens if things go badly? Well, in broad terms, think about remedies in this way. There are remedies via the regulators and there are remedies via the courts. How does the GDPR envisage remedies via the regulator? Well, first question is, who do you complain to if you are a data subject? Which regulator do you contact? Do you have to find out where the data controller is established and contact that one? Well, no, it's very much in your hands. You can lodge a complaint with your home country or your country of habitual residence or place of work, or you can complain about where the processing happened. So data subjects are put into the driving seat of, in terms of the battleground they want to fight on. Data subjects are given an express right to effective judicial remedies against not only data controllers, but against regulators as well. And the monetary penalty provisions that have got a lot of press time already, it's a multi-tiered approach, so it depends on the type of offence. The eye-catching up to 4% of total worldwide annual turnover is the point that a lot of you will have picked up. That does exist in the new GDPR, so that huge headline maximum liability approach is there. But a lot remains to be seen about how regulators will actually impose those eye-watering fines in future. Lastly, what about your rights to complain to a court? Which court do you complain to if you want to bring legal action? Again, it's the first point is, well, complain where the data controller is established, or you can complain where you, the data subject, have your own habitual residence or place of work. So once again, data subject is effectively in control of the battleground and gets to choose. Compensation, again, you heard from Chris on this. What's the future of the right to be compensated? Well, Article 77 puts on a clear footing that there is a right to be compensated for both material and immaterial damage resulting from infringements of the GDPR. So there is, once again, a confronting of what have been seen as limitations on data subjects' rights under the current world order and a widening of that picture in very much a data controller-friendly, or data subject-friendly, rather, data subject-driven regime. That is the new world order that we're moving into. Lots of homework for you and clients you advise to get your houses in order before the new order comes in 2 years or so. There's a lot more in the slides. That's been slightly over time, so I think we're over to Last questions before lunch. Thank you.